Glad to be back at Perimeter. It's been about 4 years since I've been around, so it's good to come here once in a while. So today I'll be talking about dark matter physics. So we're going to be assuming that there is something like dark matter in the world. Of course, not everyone seems to agree on that, but most of this talk is going to be assuming that there's dark matter inside galaxies. And the main purpose of this talk is to try to answer this question that I've essentially been working on for the last, I don't know, 4 or 5 years now. So can we really distinguish between a galaxy whose dark matter halo is something like a CDM halo that has a lot of substructures on much smaller scales versus something that has much less structures on smaller scale, like in a warm dark matter model, or other theories of dark matter where dark matter has a late decoupling which suppress powers on small scale. So the question that I'm trying to answer today is, can we distinguish these two scenarios by looking at various kind of data? And if you actually want, and my point here is actually if you do want to learn about dark matter physics, is that you need to go inside these galaxies. Because at large scales, dark matter physics is essentially irrelevant for the formation of large scale structures. So this is actually the same simulation. So these are all in-body simulation images. Like the previous one I was showing you that was zoomed in, but this is a large scale structure simulation. This is a box about 145 megaparsecs on the side. And here actually we're showing two very different theories of dark matter. And I'll come back a bit later about what these theories are. But what you can see here, despite the lighting, is that essentially they look the same on large scales. And these two pictures are essentially the same as the dark matter physics has been used to generate these two pictures. So on large scales, everything is the same. And so large scale structure is necessarily a very good probe of the microphysics of dark matter. But if you look inside galaxies, then you can learn a lot of things about dark matter. So that's important.
So axions could look like that as well if they're light enough.
Sure. Okay. I was talking about a standard like axion that looks like cold dark matter. Okay. Sure. All right. Fair enough. Okay.
Now, if you have light enough axion.
Yeah. I totally agree with you. Totally agree with the point.
It's not the same as something.
No, it's not.
So again, looking at these pictures, I mean my point that you'd have to look, so this dark matter physics I want to look at is locked deep inside gravitational potential wells of galaxies, and hence my title. And the first question you might ask, but I think it might be obvious to a lot of you, but why is the answer always on small scale? I mean, it's just really causality, really. I mean, this microphysics in the dark matter sector that caused these deviations on small scale structures is all caused by causal physics, either through free streamings or collisional damping or these kind of things, which is causally active. And it can only propagate so much during the age of the universe or the time that physics was active until decoupling or the free streaming stopped. So essentially this microphysics of dark matter tends to modify power spectrums of small scales or large wave number. And here actually I'm showing you the matter power spectrums of these models that I was showing you in the previous picture. So in the previous picture I was showing you n-body simulation for CDM, which is the standard kind of black line, this dimensionless power spectrum here. But I was also showing you this M1 model that we call here that has a lot of wiggles and damping in its power spectrum. And of course the main difference is that there's much less powers on small scales in these models. And the reason why these acoustic peaks here is a bit like the same reason why there's BAO. In the large scale structure, that there was some acoustic physics in the dark matter sector that caused acoustic phenomena, sound wave essentially traveling until the epoch of decoupling, and it gives rise to these wiggles. And of course, the decoupling between dark matter and whatever was driving these oscillations is not perfect, and you have some equivalent of still damping being active here. So the point here is that there's different dark matter physics, either through kind of pressure supported acoustic oscillation, or just pure free streaming, like these warm dark matter model here that have just a sample kind of exponential cutoff in the matter power spectrum. It gives rise to different kind of matter power spectrum on small scales. And it might not be obvious to distinguish these in reality, because of course, as I was saying before, all of these small scales are collapsed into bound halos today. So sometimes it's easier to think about these small scale structures in terms of roughly spherical over densities or halos. And suddenly you can look at the halo mass functions, so essentially mass versus the total numbers of halos at a given mass. And again, for these models I was showing you at this power spectrum, you get different shape of this mass function because, again, at the small mass or large wave number, there's different kinds of power. So again, there's nothing too surprising here. Now, so inside these galaxies, so these scales, you're actually probing 10 to the 10 solar mass. You're at the dwarf galaxy scale, so you're probing satellites of galaxies, essentially. And again, considering my first pictures I show you, at these small mass scale, the CDM is a lot more small scale structures than these other models. So one thing I wanted to do, so there's different ways we can probe dark matter physics, and kind of standard way, direct detection, or looking at annihilation and decay products of dark matter inside the Milky Way or other objects, or we can also try to produce it at LHC. But what I want to do here, since I'm an astrophysicist, I want to try to reveal the physics of dark matter through purely gravitational physics. So gravitational effects on normal matter that I want to go and observe to try to infer information about what's the physics of dark matter. So the advantage of using the purely gravitational probe, so it's kind of somewhat of a model independent thing where you don't have to assume a particular kind of operator coupling the dark matter to the standard model of particle physics, kind of contrast to direct and indirect detection. Of course, there's a big caveat here, is that, well, astrophysics is messy, galaxy formation is complicated, and of course, baryons play a major role. So there's definitely some challenges in going down that road. And I'm going to take up the challenge and run with it. So in the first, for the next few minutes, I'm going to describe which kind of dark matter physics I would like to go and probe with this kind of gravitational interaction. So this is kind of a shameless self-advertisement for all the works I've been doing the last year or so about different dark matter models. But I just want to illustrate that there's actually some of these models I want to talk about are well-motivated and interesting to talk about. So, of course, everyone has heard about warm dark matter, and people usually show the matter power spectrum, but I already showed you that a few slides ago. So I decided to show you in real space. So this is just a density field in the warm dark matter on your right-hand side, and essentially the warm dark matter free streams the early universe because it is relativistic, and that wipes out structure on small scales. And you can just see this by eye versus the CDM here. You've smoothed out your density field. Now, one dark matter is interesting by itself, but maybe it's actually a bit more interesting now, for some people anyway. So there's this controversial, and I want to emphasize that it's still quite controversial. X-ray signal that's been seen the last, I guess, couple of years by now. It's about looking galaxy clusters, stacking on galaxy clusters with X-rays telescopes, seen unidentified signal. And so we did this work recently, and this is one of the plot from this work. But here we're showing essentially these constraints from these X-ray signal here on the mixing angle of these sterile neutrinos with the standard model neutrinos and their mass. So these contours are fitted to the X-ray flux, and these are upper limits on the mixing angle from different other observations. So this is this band here is from staring at this Perseus cluster, and then there was some other. So that was the work of Boyarsky et al.
My attention, then it's in the cusp, and there are upper limits that are lower.
Yeah. I'll come back to that. There's a regime where the 2 sigma upper limit for say M31 of the dwarfs are right where the signal from clusters is. So there's kind of mild tension here, but you just at the point where the situation is still interesting. And the point I was going to mention back later is that this is a model that can be falsified in the next couple of years, essentially. So that's why it's interesting to kind of work on it now, because it's a model you can just like rule out or rule in. So the situation is kind of interesting now. So now the thing is, if you have these model parameters with a mass about 7 keV, 7.1 keV, and these kinds of mixing angle with standard model neutrinos, first we already know they can be kind of decoherence produce standard steron neutrinos, like in kind of Dodderson-Widrow fashion. It can already be because it will be too warm and wipe out too many too much structures in the universe. So if you have such parameter space, you have to invoke kind of more Baroque production mechanism for these neutrinos. And that's what we did here. Actually, there was a production mechanism that was proposed about 20 years ago by Shi and Fuller, which is based on essentially these resonant mechanisms, where you have a lepton asymmetry in your primordial plasma, and that drives resonant production of these steron neutrinos at very particular momentum. And this is what we studied in more detail here. So essentially, because you have these plasma interactions, this is in the early universe, you tend to produce the neutrinos in two momentum bins. And this is actually what this is showing here. Instead, I'm showing the steron neutrino production as a function of temperature. So the color scheme is actually temperature here. And so at a high temperature, you have essentially two bands. So you have a band here and a band here. And essentially, as the temperature cools down, these bands swipe the momentum space, and you produce these neutrinos, these steron neutrinos, at different momenta. But the point is that this lower momentum band resonance is actually more effective. So you tend to produce, with this mechanism, a lot lower momentum neutrinos, steron neutrinos. So this warm dark matter is not too warm. It's kind of colder than standard Dodderson-Widrow kind of thing. Now, as any kind of model of dark matter, is always a tooth fairy. And the tooth fairy here from model better is that this requires a lepton asymmetry that's 10 to the minus 4, 10 to the minus 5, about 5 orders of magnitude above the Baryon asymmetry. And that's a challenge for model building, for sure. And you need this asymmetry to get the right relic abundance given the mixing angle and the mass of these particles. So that's the tooth fairy in this kind of scenario. Now, there's another twist to this kind of model, and that's why we got interested into it. And that was our main contribution, actually, to this problem, because this problem has been around for a long time for these resonance-produced neutrinos, is that these things actually produce rise of the QCD phase transition. It's kind of a coincidence of scales, but this is actually showing the number of densities in steron neutrinos and anti-steron neutrinos as a function of temperature. And you see that the bulk of the production is the log plus, so the bulk of the production happens over here, is actually between 200 and 100 MeV. This happens right at the QCD is going, where the degrees of freedom of the QCD sector is dropping dramatically because you're forming these mesons and hadrons. And that's actually that complicates the picture here. Because not only because the number of degrees of freedom of the plasma is dropping dramatically, so the Hubble rate is affected and so on, you're dumping a lot of entropy, but also because these models rely on a symmetry in the plasma. So it's a lepton asymmetry. And because leptons and quarks talk to one another via the weak interaction, the asymmetry in the lepton sector is communicated in the quark sector. And as you go to this transition, the quark balance is affected because the quarks are going to meson and hadrons. And that affects actually the way the leptons are reacting themselves. And the details in the paper is actually a very interesting thermodynamics problem to solve. Everything is more or less in equilibrium, but the chemical potential keeps shifting between the quarks and the leptons. So we build that physics into the production calculation for the first time. So that was interesting to do. And at the end of the day, once you turn the crank, it actually compute this production for these steron neutrinos. You end up with these PSDs, so these phase-based densities here. And as I mentioned earlier, these are colder than standard Fermi Dirac, because you can excite mostly the low momentum modes of these neutrinos in the production. So here, this kind of dashed line is what you would have for Fermi Dirac neutrinos, a steron neutrino. But actually, most of these scenarios are compatible with this 3.5 kV line excess, tend to be a lot colder than a standard thermal relic, which is interesting from structure formation point of view, which is what we care about today for this talk. So once you have the PSDs, it's just a matter of turning a crank to get the actual transfer function for these kind of dark matter particles. And this is what we get. So this is the transfer function of these steron neutrinos dark matter to the standard CDM, the function of K mode. And these are all the same model I showed you earlier. And it's kind of interesting that they kind of lie right around this region, which is close to this 2 kV warm dark matter, which is close to this Lyman alpha bound. But it's also, it's been proposed to kind of explain and or at least somewhat alleviate these small scale structure problems like the formation of cores and these kind of things. So it lies right. It's kind of a coincidence that it lies right at this point. I mean, it didn't have to work that way, but it does for some reason. But I think the situation is actually more interesting than that. So if you notice here, so the color scheme here now is the mixing angle with the sterile neutrinos with the standalone neutrinos. And what you see here is that there's a hierarchy from low mixing angle to high mixing angle.
Can you explain it more? Because in the previous talk, you were talking about the X-ray excess. The first peak mass was 77 kV.
Yeah.
So what this is 2 kV that you have there?
Yeah, yeah.
So what's going on?
No, but these line, color line are 7 kV neutrinos, but they're non-thermal. They don't have a Fermi Dirac distribution. So the transfer function, is not, and so what I call 2 kV is M thermal. So it would be a 2 kV that has a thermal spectrum. Yeah. So these 7 kV neutrinos have transfer function that are more like a 2 kV thermal relic. But it's not exactly, because the shape, as you see, the shape is actually different also. So there's this hierarchy of mixing angle here, where the lowest mixing angle guys here is actually colder. They tend to be warmer, while the guys with a larger mixing angle tend to be colder. So this is warmer, this is colder, right? So these guys that have the high mixing angle are the easiest to constrain by the X-ray. Right, because it mix more with the neutrinos, the flux is larger, and so on. Well, these guys have lower mixing angle, which are hard to constrain by X-ray, because the flux is much lower, are much easier to constrain by structure formation. So you have this nice thing where X-rays come from one side, and structure formation comes from the other side. And that's what I said earlier, is that you can close this parameter space pretty soon. And it's kind of, I don't think it had to work that way, just the way the physics work. You have this hierarchy with the mixing angle that makes it interesting that you can close this parameter space pretty quickly.
Do you happen to know that this large left-hand infinity scenario is that, can you produce it by, you know, can this combination of left-hand and varying asymmetry be produced by a left adenosine scenario, by just the standard model plus three right-handed neutrinos?
I don't know the details about that. And I think it's an interesting problem for model builders, but it's a bit above my pay grade, as far as I know. I'm sorry. I mean, I think it's a very interesting problem, but I haven't worked on this. Yeah. So the situation here is interesting, and I think you should keep in mind is this around neutrinos will stay interesting. And upcoming X-ray observation with Astro H is actually, so these around neutrino dark matter is actually now the primary target for Astro H. So they'll be looking at this first. So the situation is quite interesting. Will you be able to come down with these X-ray constraints while the structure formation constraint, which was what I'm talking about today and what other people are doing by alignment alpha and so on, come up this plot to kind of close this parameter space. So this model is kind of interesting. It has actual clear.
Yeah. Sorry, just
finish. Oh, no, sorry.
So just to play devil's advocate.
Of course.
And I guess the main systematic that people talk about is like this is not actual, signal from standard neutrino, but rather the passive lines of the range. That's treated properly.
I say controversial.
Yeah, so it's not clear that more data is going to help that. Well, I don't know.
Well, I think it will help if you can resolve the line, right? Because then you can map the kinematic of the dark. You can map the kinematic of the dark matter that you expect inside these clusters, right? Because now we don't resolve the line; it's just a blob. But if you can see the blue shift and the redshift of the line as the dark matter particle orbit the halos, then you can.
We know the kinematic of the potassium band.
Okay.
At
some point, I don't know. Well, I mean, I think that, well, if it's, I think the hot X-ray gas will actually behave differently, right?
Well,
It's part of the modeling problem, for sure.
I mean, I remember, I guess, 10 years ago, Sunyak was talking about half rate is going to be with Astro H because of turbulence in clusters by looking at the structure of lines. So,
okay.
So there is something that's obviously to be learned there.
Yeah.
And I guess on the other side, lambda and alpha, is always people have been suspicious that there's baryonic physics going on there.
I'm the most skeptical of lambda and alpha constraints. But yeah,
I guess that window is going to be closed conclusively.
Well, that's at least from my perspective, I think I'm working on working this way, not with Lyman alpha, but with other things. So, yeah.
What about the detecting there are neutrino.
Like in the lab?
LHC, etc. 7 keV.
Yeah, but the mixing is really low. And the lifetime is really big. I think the prospects are not great.
You have to be able to see it.
Yeah, I mean, okay, so if you want to be 100% sure, you'll have to see it. But I think that'll be really challenging. Maybe the LHC is not the best way to go.
So how about this mini boon and things like that? Does this have any relevance to
that? My understanding is not in the near future. It's going to be a lot. So we had this, I organized one of these dark matter meetings at Caltech when I was there. So people working with Catrin, these spectrometers for neutrino mass. Like essentially what they were saying is that if you go like two or three generations past that, you might be able to start probing certain parameters in sterile neutrino space. But I think it's still that's really futuristic by neutrino spectrometry, essentially. So is there any more question about the sterile neutrino / warm dark matter business? Yeah.
How well does it fit Galaxy rotation curves and cluster dynamics compared to which?
As far as we're concerned, everything is the same as CDM on these scales. Right? On cluster scales, it definitely looks like CDM, right? So the thermal velocities of these warm dark matter is really small, right? Because they have colder PSDs. So they behave like cold dark matter on cluster scales. And even the rotation curves of galaxies pretty much unchanged. The only place when it can really change the very center of galaxies may form these cores because of thermal velocities. But
it tells you how it fits cluster position.
The interaction cross section is really small. Like the self interaction. The self interaction cross section to this is really small, right?
So yeah. I think you evade these cluster now.
Just touch like CDM.
Yeah, it just behaves like CDM. Yeah. All right. So another model that's qualitatively actually different is models where dark matter is actually late decoupling. So it stay couples to some plasma, either standard model, which is slightly more constrained, or its own other plasma in the dark sector until later time than a standard WIMP. Scenarios, much, much later time. And again, I'm showing this in real space just for to make a difference here. And again, this is a CDM, and this is these lead decoupling models. And it's actually different than the warm dark matter. And actually, you can pick up by eye, it's kind of cool, that there's an extra scale in the problem here that I've actually indicated by this circle. And that's essentially the sound horizon of dark matter. This is like the BAO scale of dark matter. You kind of pick it up by eye here. Because there's an extra scale that comes into problems. Of course, if you look at the correlation function of this density field, you just take the two-point correlation function, this scale just pops out at you. So I'm plotting the galaxy correlation function. It's a function of physical scale with actually real data put on top. And so this is the BAO scale that we all love as standard, being very well measured by now. And these models that have these extra coupling to relativistic particle at early times, they have this extra scale, which shows up as an extra bump in this galaxy correlation function. And depending on which kind of coupling you have, at what time the coupling happens, this scale can take a variety of values. But in this paper that we did where this plot is taking from, we essentially said that everything has to be on nonlinear scale. That is small scale, and hence the title of my talk. So this if this scale is there, it exists. It has to be on subgalactic scale, essentially.
Like
the BAO.
Yeah.
So that's a known issue. Yeah. But this is the DR9, and this is just like multiplying the matter power spectrum by a constant bias. I mean, just like. Right. I didn't try to model the BAO feature. I mean, people do with a lot more fancy analyses now.
All these error bars are also highly correlated to the high school.
But also,
so, yeah, may I say it's a non-issue. Is this an issue or is it not an issue?
So here the thing is, people actually they actually reconstruct the BO feature. They do that. They reconstruct the BO feature. Here I'm just putting the raw data.
I often talk about the place. I'm not quite sure. Is the amplitude actually discrepant, or is it just within one sigma what you expect?
So actually, I've asked the same question to people actually doing this, and so. They mostly care about where the scale is, that is where the position, but the shape of it, not so much. Wow. But I think there's interesting information there. There's actually interesting information. But yeah, and I actually thought about that myself. So there's actually useful information here that's maybe not fully taken into account. So yeah, feel free to work on that. I think it's an interesting question. So I'm talking about these models that have light decoupling here. And so one of the points here is that compared to, say, warm dark matter or spiral neutrino I was talking just about earlier, these models are a bit richer because you have more knobs to turn. There's an extra scale in the problems, which you kind of illustrate here. So warm dark matter, as I said, just has this cutoff. But here you have all these wiggles. But these wiggles are going to be damp at some point because the coupling between this plasma and dark matter is never 100% efficient. It's always some viscosity and damping that comes into problem. So these models have fundamentally they have two scales. This what I call this DAO scale, which is interested in the scale of these wiggles, the dark acoustic oscillation wiggles, and the some damping. So there's essentially two knobs you can play, and that makes these models a bit richer to play with. So you can think about two scenarios essentially where you consider the value of the sound horizon versus the damping scale. So you can have models like this one I was illustrating on the previous slide, where you have lots of undamped wiggle. And that's a model with a sound horizon is much larger than a damping scale. It gives rise to a lot of these well-defined wiggles. Another kind of corner parameter space was the DAO is essentially the damping scale, in which case you essentially have no wiggles or very damped wiggles. And you have all the cases in between. So another point here is that the phenomenology here of these models is a lot richer, gives you more knobs to play with. And in terms of ALO mass function of these kind of things, you get different shape than just simple parallel or exponential cutoffs. Which is some work we did with Matt Buckley last year. Now, I've already introduced some new physics in dark matter sectors. I've introduced some new interaction that gives rise to these pressure-supported acoustic oscillation to do some coupling to dark radiations or to neutrinos or what have you. I mean, people have worked on different models. But since I've already introduced some new physics, it's not a big leap of faith to say, well, these models can have some self-interaction at late times inside halos. So I think that these models are kind of naturally self-interacting dark matter candidate. And moreover, their self-interaction has non-trivial velocity dependence. This is what I'm showing here. This is actually the same models I had at the beginning of the talk, these M1, M2, M3, with these wiggle power spectra. But the same physics that was giving rise to these power spectra with wiggles actually gives rise to this non-trivial velocity dependence of the cross-section, the self-interaction cross-section inside halos today. And depending which model you have these different values. And the point is that they fall at high velocity with like a Coulomb-type behavior and they plateau at low velocity. And the main effect of these having these self-interaction inside halos is that they can warm up very cold particles in centers of halos and kick them to larger orbit. That leads to the formation of cores in size. This is what this is showing from this work that's forthcoming. So we do all these n-body simulation, look at the structure of halos in SIDM, self-interacting dark matter, and we see that depending on the value of the cross-section, you form these cores, and the size of the cores and the amplitude of the core depends on the size of the cross-section. So this is kind of well-known by now. So now the question I asked earlier is like, which dark matter physics can I probe with this gravitational interaction, which is what I've been answering the last few minutes. So you want to determine something like decoupling epochs, or the epochs where the dark matter power spectrum start deviating from pure CDM. We'd like to determine if there is such a scale in small scale structure, we'd like to determine that. And whether there's some kind of self-interaction that influences the very center of these halos. So again, the question that we want to answer is whether we can distinguish these types of galactic halos.
If you take the cross section for self-interacting dark matter, so centimeter squared per gram of CTSU,
yeah,
and if you convert it to nuclear physics, the strength between two protons from this force.
Yeah.
It's huge. It's a very strong force.
Yeah, 1 centimeter squared per gram is about a half a barn per GeV, right? Yeah,
it's 20 times.
Yeah, yeah.
Strange, this object does not interact with anything else, but with itself has this enormous interaction.
It's true, yeah.
Maybe that's bizarre, I don't know.
It is slightly bizarre, but it doesn't really, I still sleep at night. I'm okay with it. Okay.
Bird of a feather together.
Something like
that. All right. So I've discussed some models of dark matter that essentially modify the small scale structure of the universe, especially the structures that are inside galaxies today. And now we'd like to go and look for these structures, or their absence, or just the structure of their structures. And I will say there's essentially two approaches you can take to do that. You can either study to death or a very local neighborhood, the local group, by looking at the population and the dynamics and the kinematics of all the Milky Way satellites that we know, and the new one that we are discovering, and it's actually a big effort going to this direction. I think it's actually really, really interesting. And I would say that you can actually, or the other approach, which is the one I'm taking, and I'm not saying it's better or anything, it's just different, is using gravitational lensing to actually study the substructure inside galaxies. Now, just one slide about the first approach. So we have a lot of neighbors, and we're discovering a lot more. And actually, this is outdated. There's actually more candidates now from the dark energy surveys. So we have a lot of neighboring galaxies, dwarf galaxies, or ultra-faint dwarf galaxies. And we're populating this diagram very nicely. And by studying the properties, we can start to learn something about dark matter. And actually, I think that's something that everyone should pay attention in the next few years. Because the approach I'm taking is slightly different than that, and I want to talk about gravitational lensing. And I guess the nice thing about lensing is that there's a lot of pretty pictures to look at, so it makes for a nice talk. But so there's a whole zoo of gravitational lenses that you can use to study the small-scale structure inside galaxies. Here I'm just showing three different categories, but actually more than that. And I'm interested mostly in galaxy-scale gravitational lens because, as I said, I want to probe subgalactic scales, so inside galaxies. Cluster scales are interesting, but they don't necessarily tell me what I want to know. So that's why I'm actually focusing on galaxy-scale gravitational lenses here. So some of these nice objects are galaxy quasar lenses. So it's a big, massive galaxy sitting in front of a high redshift quasar. It gives rise to kind of multiple images of the bright quasar. So what you see, this is the first column. And of course, these quasars can then live in some host galaxies, or creating supermassive black holes. So you also see the actual host galaxy on these big arcs, rings, and stuff. So there's a lot of structure in these images. Another category is interesting is galaxy-galaxy lensing, in which case there's no quasar in the middle, but you only see the host galaxy itself that's being lensed by big, massive elliptical galaxies in the foreground. Or you can actually look at this in the submillimeters. We have these kind of dusty high redshift galaxy that get lensed by foreground structures into multiple images that you can find in the SPT maps, for instance. So there's different kinds of lenses that you could use to try to study the inner working of these galaxies, the galaxies that do the lensing. So gravitational lensing is an easy problem to deal with. It's pretty straightforward, and probably most of you will see this, right? The geometry is really simple. You have a source, you have a lens, you have an image, and that's pretty it. And the fact that this is massive bends the light and causes multiple images is kind of standard lensing. And I'm be working in the strong lensing regime, so there are multiple images here. This is not weak lensing. And I want to put this in perspective, or rather to scale. So when you look at one of these images, this is RxJ1131, which I showed you just before from an image from HST. So when you look at this image, it's actually probing the very center of these dark matter halos. This is more or less to scale. So when you look at this image, you're actually probing the very center of the galactic halos. And remember that this is about 500 kiloparsec on the side. So you're really probing the very center part here with this image. Now, what I really want to study is not necessarily the galaxy itself, but its substructure contents, all the small-scale structure that are inside galaxies. And And I want to illustrate a bit what this does to the lensing. So I made this little very low-key movie. So what I've done here is I've taken a configuration actually that's like this, and that's so I mapped these three images. This is the three quasar here, and that's the fourth one over there. And what I've done is I've taken actually a CDM scenario here. Actually, no, more. I've taken this one, so the M1 scenario here, and I've taken all these sub-ALUs. And what I do is that I keep the sub-ALUs, but I just change the position. So I reshuffle them inside the galaxy. And every time I do, then I do my lensing calculation. And then I reshuffle and do it again, and this is what this is going. So every frame of this movie is a different reorganization of these sub-ALUs. And here, so I'm illustrating the shift in the image position. So these little images actually are shifting in position, but the brightness are also shifting, and that's actually the size of the dots. Some of them can become brighter or less bright depending on the substructure configuration.
Yeah. Distance from the center of the plot, or that's the angle.
No. I keep them at the same distance.
Okay, do that. Change that theta and fibers. But
yeah, I kind of change on their orbit where they are. Right? Try to be a bit self-consistent here. So this is actually what happens when you. So the effect we're looking for essentially these kind of effects. Not in a movie picture, because the dynamical timescale for these things is kind of long. But this is the kind of effect we're looking for. The fact that compared to a purely smooth halos where there was no substructure, which is actually the case with these big crosses here. So those would be the images you will get, the location of the images you will get if there was no substructure. And once you put substructure, you get this little deflection and change in brightness. And this is kind of the effect we're looking for. Because it gives this solution the signatures of these substructures. Of course, it's more complicated than that. And then what I'm not showing you here is the time domain aspect of it, the fact that not only is the brightness and position of these images are changing, but the arrival time delays of these things are actually changing too when you reshuffle these substructures. And that's actually very important. And I'll come back to that. Now, of course, I'm not the first one to think about that. I mean, people have been thinking about this for 13, 14 years by now. Probably longer than that, actually. So the first paper that really kind of put this on the map, I think, was Dalal and Kuchinek in 2002, where they used 7 radio-level quasars to put constraints on the fraction of the mass in satellites, which is more or less some kind of substructure fraction in projection, as well as the typical mass scale of these substructures, measuring an arc second here, but it's really a mass scale. And there's multiple contour here, and that the only difference that whatever you assume for your photometric precision here is the 5%, the 10%, the 20%. Of course, the bigger the contour, the bigger is the uncertainty. But essentially what they got was something that was more or less consistent with CDM, with kind of very, very big error bars. But it was a very clever calculation, a very clever method that he used to actually get that out, and it's actually a really interesting read. More recently, in a very different regime, there's this thing called gravitational imaging, which I think is very interesting. Now, instead of trying to detect things statistically, you're actually trying to detect them directly, more like direct detection of substructure. You want to pinpoint the mass and the location of the substructure inside halos. So that's a kind of a tough business. But it was actually very successful. It was published in Nature, 3 years ago. Here what you do is that you have this data from, say, HST, and you look again for these residuals between modeling the gravitational lens potential with this purely smooth structure or having a smooth structure plus little sub-ALUs on top of it. It's a bit like I was showing you before when I was reshuffling these sub-ALUs. Except now you're trying to pinpoint the location of these sub-ALUs. What they do, so they take their data, they have a model for the lens, and they look at the residuals. And using that, they can actually identify the location and mass of some of the sub-ALUs. But if you look at this, so I think there's an important caveat here, is that if you look at this, so this is actually where the sub-ALU is, and there's some mass, 10 to the 10 solar mass, I think. But it lies exactly, essentially, at the point where this image is brightest, which is at the minima of the time delay surface. And it's no surprise actually that you find it there, because that's where the cross section for finding a sub-ALU is highest. That's where you're the most sensitive to find a sub-ALU. So this technique essentially allows you as a very fastly rapidly decaying cross-section for detection as you move outward of the ring. And it's not a surprise, actually, you found the subhalos right on top of the brightest spot. That's just the way it is. That's just a drawback of using these kind of methods. But I think this is actually really interesting. And that's kind of inspiring me to do more work in that direction. I'll be talking about it in a minute. This is
like 5 10 sigma. I mean, they have a pretty insane threshold. I think it's like a 10 sigma. Mm-hmm. So they're pretty sure there's something there. Yeah.
And it's about 10 to the tensile going around.
Yeah.
So this is which data?
This is
one of the Slax lens, I think.
Slax is what?
Sloan's legacy.
Okay, so it's
one of the it's
HST. It's HST, yeah.
Do they just use the position of images for this? Or I guess this is just the image.
They model the full ring, the full surface brightness map.
The full surface.
Yeah, and then they just take a difference between the two. That's a residual. And their data is really the residual. They do statistics. Well,
the halo is like a perfect.
Yeah, I think here it's
like an isothermal sphere, essentially.
So wouldn't that make a difference? I mean, if you just some more general halo, then it's more aware.
So they
essentially they do this Bayesian inference thing where they have their smooth halo model has an Einstein radius, a slope, an ellipticity, and is also an external shear from the large scale structure. So the model is still fairly general. It doesn't include higher multiple, which is what we talked about yesterday. Mm-hmm. So looking at this, there might be an issue. That there's some, that maybe the halo is, I mean, the smooth model is not flexible enough to actually accommodate it. But the detection is still very, it's very strong.
Something as I'm going to take a question from this.
Yeah. And people actually, so Keaton is actually working on trying to reinterpret these kind of. So the question is like, can you say this is really a 10 to the 10 halo, so on the mass halo, or is it like a bunch of 10 to the 9 clumped together? Or is it, so there's some question about what actually you're actually measuring here. And people are actually working to try to answer that question. Yeah.
So you claim to be able to tell something significant about the inner core of galaxy halos, the inner core.
This is the same scale as before. So this is the very central 7 kiloparsecs of the galactic halo.
Oh, the barons are included in the mass model.
So the mass model you use to this in the model here, it contains dark matter halo plus the baryons.
So you can solve the cusp problem.
The thing is, what lensing really constrained is the mass inside the Einstein radius. It doesn't really tell you whether that mass is in dark matter or in baryons. It just tells you the total. That's what lensing does. Lensing is sensitive to the total mass. Doesn't matter if that mass is in dark matter or baryons. And what the model, so the most constrained parameters of this model here is actually the mass inside the Einstein ring. That's the best. You have a very good handle on that. But whether that mass is slightly spiky or slightly less spiky, that's a lot more uncertain. But that's a feature of lensing, and it's been around for a long time.
Yeah. Well, around 15 years ago, people used to say, "Look at clusters; they are shallower than what you expect from FW." I don't know if it's still there. These regions are very much affected by baryonic physics, so I guess it's not even clear what you should expect from CGM.
If this is Slax, it's probably a giant elliptical, so it's almost all baryons. It's not a little dwarf galaxy or something. It's a big elliptical.
Which has some 10 to the 10 solar mass up in the
The main one.
Yeah,
the main lens is a big
elliptical. Because as you approach the core, baryons take more.
Yep.
So, what does it say about dark matter in there?
Oh, what it says about dark matter is not about the big halos, it's about this little guy.
That's all they're saying in this paper. I mean, that's the point, right? We about the substructure here, not the overall scale of the halo here. So what this is a Nature paper is because you found a little guy that you cannot see in the optical image, right? So there's no optical counterpart or X-ray counterpart or anything. This thing is really dark, as far as we know. where you can still detect it's very significantly that there's some kind of overdensity there. So that was the big deal about this. There's a third thing that I need to mention, and I should try to keep on time. So this is from Ezavi et al. With Neil Dalal and other people, and they're instead of trying to measure individual suballeles like in the gravitational imaging I was showing in the previous slide, now we're trying to do a truly statistical picture where you take these ALMA images of gravitational of lens submillimeter galaxies, and you look for a small fluctuation in these maps. To put a constraints on the power spectrum of these substructures inside galaxies. Okay.
Is it extremely unlikely that this extra halo that they detect is like could it just be another background or foreground object?
There's a kernel, definitely. It could be in a bit in the foreground, a bit in the background.
It's detected at 10 sigmas. Like, how unlikely is it that it's not gravitationally bound to the main halo?
Oh, I don't think we know if it's gravitationally bound.
Okay.
It could definitely be a foreground structure or a background structure. But the Lensing kernel, so this broad kernel that kind of picks things at different redshift differently. So it cannot be a lot in front or a lot backward. But the thing is, what you measure here is like the surface density, like projected. So whether that mass is actually in one object at one redshift or a bunch of objects that happen to be aligned and it gets smooshed together. So that's what I mean. That the interpretation of this result is still not fully clear. Yeah. But what they did in that paper, they took that halos and interpreted it as a bound subhalos. And use that to learn something about the halo mass function. Or put constraint on the halo mass function with one halo. Actually, you can do that, actually. Yeah. So that was one of halos, but I think it's more interesting to talk about the population of the halos. So since in CDM theories and other dark matter theories, there tend to be a lot of substructure inside. So I think talking about the power spectrum of substructure inside galaxies is actually interesting. In fact, it's so interesting, I think that's what people should be focusing on, their effort on. And here, from this paper, this is like a forecast from ALMA data with potential ALMA data, showing the possible constraint you could get on this convergence power spectrum. This is essentially now the projected power spectrum of the plane of the sky, in 2D. And so this is the constraint they get, and the black line is for 10-hour exposure, and the red line is with 40 hours exposure. Which is very challenging. Was that?
The curve is a prediction for NFW halos with a mass cut off for, I think, 10 to the 6 solar mass. I'll actually come back to that because I'll show the full plot with all the prediction later.
Yeah. What's the window function?
Yeah.
Linear scales.
Yeah, this is highly nonlinear. You're probing the inside, what's a two-point function inside galaxy. So now I've told you about two different approaches that people have taken. So gravitational imaging, this power spectrum approach, and Neil and Dalal and Kuchinek with this radio loud quasar. But now actually what I really want to do is have all these data and I want to kind of develop like a framework that I can feed this data in and gets constrained on dark matter substructure. It doesn't matter if it's a submillimeter galaxy that's lens, or a radio lock quasar, or galaxy-galaxy lensing. So it's kind of ambitious, but at the same time, I think it's just a matter of setting up the right framework. Like a bit like for the CMB, where you know exactly how to compute the fluctuation of the CMB. Doesn't matter which patch of the sky you're looking at. So we want to do the same thing here. Develop a framework that allows you to apply to any type of gravitational lensing. So the basic here, the thing is, lensing is actually pretty simple. And if you ask me what's the one equation that you need to know about lensing, and that's it. This is lensing in one equation. That's all you need to know. And I think that's pretty cool. So lensing is just a map, right? You map a source plane to an image plane via some mass density that kind of bends the way the light in different ways. So that's really all there is to lensing. So we have some source that has some surface brightness profile at point x, and I want to know what's its image in the image plane. Then this is what I need to do. So I need to evaluate the source at the lens equation, which essentially just shifts the light depending on the gravitational potential of the lens, but also shift the timestamp of the light, because the light has to escape different gravitational potential depending which way it goes inside the galaxies. So there's a gravitational time shift here. And usually I look at this through telescopes, so I don't need to worry about point spread function and atmospheric effect. So this is all encoded in the PSF. So I need to convolve this image, the source, with the PSF. And generally there'll be light from the actual galaxy that does the lensing, which, because it sits in the foreground and it contains stars and gas and so on. So there'd be some light coming from the central galaxy here I have to add. And this is actually my model for what this image looked like, and it's pretty accurate as far as I know. And this is actually describe all the gravitational lensing. So that's my starting point. And let's just play a little game with this. And I just want to do this as a simple example. Right? Take a source, there's some galaxy that's some ellipticity, and I put it in front of some circle over density. And what I get, just by playing this equation, I just show you, get some arcs, some lens image, and that's pretty simple. Now, what happens if instead of having the smooth galaxies I just show you, this smooth kind of spherical over density, I put substructures like I did before, I put all these substructures inside, then I get this a very similar image. Actually, one of them actually contains substructure. It's been lensed by substructure, and one doesn't. Can you tell them apart? Which one contains substructure? Anyone? It's tough. It's a tough. The thing is, substructure gives very to very small effects, and that's it's hard. It's hard to tell apart. So that's exactly the point. It's hard, but you can take a difference, and yet there's actually some non-vanishing residual here, and that's a deflection field that was the substructure deflection field actually caused these little differences. Now the data we want to use is actually exactly this. It's these little residuals that tells you about this substructure deflection field that comes from all these substructure inside galaxies. And that's the game we want to play. We'd like to extract information from these residuals. Comes from, this is calculated from all over. You think, but the largest contribution, of course, you can say there's something here, right? There's a big halo here. And there's some in the periphery. But if you talk about just the surface brightness, it's clear that this guy is going to have the largest effect. But if you talk about the arrival time of different photons along these arcs, then the actual global pictures matters a lot more. Because the gravitational potential from these outer guys actually matters inside this region here, because potential is a non-local quantity. So running out, kind of want to wrap up here, but this is kind of the kind of interesting part here. But the point again is that the difference between having this kind of smooth halo and the substructure is a very small effect, as I just illustrated. So we can actually separate the lens potential that gives rise to lensing into like a zero part, which is just the smooth kind of NFW-like plus baryon halo, and a small piece that encodes all these small substructures inside the halos. And then I can actually just write down with my model for these residuals I was just showing you in the previous slides. So these residuals between the two images, when it contains only phi naught and when it contains phi naught plus pi sub, is just exactly this. The thing is actually, because this is small, you can do kind of a first order expansion. And this is the model for the residual. And the point is, these residual peaks when the gradient of the source is maximum. So if the source is constant, of course, you're going to come smooth out over the structure of the halos. You won't see any of this. So the important quantity is the gradient of the source. And this is a magnification tensor. So the brighter the image, of course, the more signal you're going to get. But it just happened that when this is maximum, the gradient of the source is exactly zero. That's just properties of lensing, because image form at the maximum of time delay surface. So this intermediate region where the maximum sensitivity is reached for substructures between when you're still fairly bright, but this gradient is non-zero. And this gradient gets dotted into this deflection field, which is exactly the substructure deflection field, which is these little vectors coming from the substructures. So this is an issue with all the residuals caused by substructure R. So it's a pretty simple model, and of course you have to convolve with the PSF because this is, look at this with telescope.
In the image by sub y,
so we observe pixels. No, actually, we're going to marginalize. That's the point.
So I guess that one of the important issues is that this is actually linear in phi. So the likelihood will be quadratic in this quantity. So then you can marginalize by hand, and that's the point here. So don't want to spend too much time on this, but you can actually do the same exercise I just did for point sources are actually time varying, that the non-vanishing light curve, because these are accreting black holes and they flare and so on. And you can also look at the residual for these point images. And now you get actually a time delay fluctuation contribution, which is proportional to the variability of the source, which makes sense, because if the source is not varying, you get no time domain information, so it's going to need that this arises. But actually, if you look at this in more details, it's going to Keaton show that when we were working on this, and essentially there are three terms, and one, the first one just tells you about the brightness of the point image, second one tells you about the time delay fluctuation, and the third one tells you about the image position shifts. So this is a three thing that can happen to a lens image. I mean, there's nothing else really that can happen from substructure. So it's nice to see that these three things just comes out naturally of this kind of toy model formalism here. So now we have some model of these image residual that are caused by substructure, and I would like to use that to backtrack some information about the dark matter that was causing these substructure in the first place. And so if these observed residuals are really explained by substructure, then the difference should be just the noise in the image, right? Now the key here is that we're gonna take this phi sub that small is caused by substructure, and we're gonna expand it in Fourier modes. Like we always do in cosmology. And again, I was just mentioning to Kendrick here, because the residuals were linear in the potential fluctuation, now the likelihood is actually a Gaussian in these variables, so you can actually just integrate them out. So you can essentially marginalize of all these little wiggles caused by substructure analytically and pull back the information, the dark matter information that was contained in the substructure. That here, I encode in this parameter Q sub, which might be something like a turnover in the power spectrum of the substructure or something like that. So that's essentially the approach here. We've kind of boiled down different approach to extracting substructure constraint from lensing, kind of put them all into a single kind of framework here. And it kind of rests in the fact that this phi k is Gaussian random field. And you'll say, well, why aren't we looking inside galaxies? How does that make any sense, right? I mean, this is a highly nonlinear regime, and so on. And how can this phi k be a Gaussian random field? And I share your concern. It's a good concern to have. The thing is, in the potential is actually always small inside galaxies. Gravitational potential are very small values. And potential is actually a non-local quantity, like its contribution from all the mass inside this galaxy, all the substructures, and so on. So there's this. So you're adding a lot of very small quantity to every point. So there's a central limit theorem that kind of kicks in, the fact that you're adding a lot of random quantities, so that at the end of the day, the potential fluctuation at every point inside a galaxy is more or less Gaussian. It's not exactly Gaussian, to be honest. I mean, there's non-Gaussianity here. But the point is, the first thing you're going to look for with this data is the power spectrum. And once you've nailed down to this to death, you can start caring about non-Gaussianity. But like the CMB, the first thing you want to measure is the power spectrum. And then nowadays, because the data is so good, we can talk about non-Gaussianity and so on. But the first thing you want to measure is the power spectrum.
Estimate for the power spectrum. That only matters. Well, it only matters if you want to know the error bar and the power spectrum. I mean, you do, but that's less of a concern than having a bias estimate of the power spectrum.
Well, but
this doesn't seem to be essential.
Well, so I mean, my thought here, and this is what I added in the next slide, is that you can actually look at the statistics of phi and do an edgeward expansion about the Gaussian case to try to determine how non-Gaussian it is. And it's actually pretty Gaussian. So that's kind of backing up my but maybe we should talk more about that. But I had a feeling that it was a necessary assumption to be able to carry out the modernization by hand. Right, if I go back, and actually go back. Right, so you have this P sub of phi k given the dark matter parameter Q sub. If this, I mean, in general, this function here can assume any form. And the assumption of Gaussianity is saying that this P sub is actually just proportional to the power spectrum, I mean, the exponential of the power spectrum. So then the whole thing is actually Gaussian, right?
This is probably too technical for me to like interrupt your talk for a long time, but I still think even if, so for this to be the true likelihood, it's true, you do need the assumption of Gaussianity. But as long as you have the linearity, as long as the linearization approximation is good,
yeah,
you gotta be able to just, you know, take what you see and square a mode and get it unbiased.
Yeah.
Part,
sure.
You
know, that I agree. Yeah.
Well, I guess, but the thing is that it kind of disagrees with you because you're looking at phi and it is IP that is looks very Gaussian because you're adding other operators. But Laplacian and phi is the surface brightness and that is much more localized. And as you showed, like there's this one single subhalo that. So it kind of depends on what you want to plot, and something may look very Gaussian and something else may not. And then depending on what you're sensitive to, you may be.
But essentially, when you look at the full residual here, so the essentially the higher order observables like the deflections are just multiplication by k, right? And then what you do is that
Fourier space that doesn't make any difference, but in real space that's there, the big difference is
yeah, of course. Right. But that's why we do it in Fourier space.
The galaxies live in real, localized in real space. So I mean, you're not.
No, we're only talking about the power spectrum, like well inside this galaxy, right? Mm-hmm. So there's essentially a largest mode you can probe, which is essentially the size of your image or something like that, right?
So you're thinking of probing those modes.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, that's right.
All right. So that was just for the Gaussianity, but maybe I can just skip that. I mean, in this paper we did over the summer, we actually studied these potential fluctuation against playing this game of putting a lot of substructure and kind of shuffling them and so on. And we went actually six order beyond Gaussianity, so there was this kind of edgeward expansion. And so the black line on these plots actually is the Gaussian case, while the red dashed line is actually the sixth order correction to that. And I mean, the black line does a pretty good job, but of course the sixth order does a bit better. These things tend to have non-zero kurtosis. But it's pretty small still. So the point is that Gaussianity is a pretty good approximation to start with. So kind of want to wrap up here, but the point is that if we want to measure this power spectrum, it actually there's very few prediction of what this power spectrum will look like in practice. And that's kind of a problem we're having right now. So we want to predict this power spectrum. So we can compute it, and this is from this paper. It's been computed in few cases, and this is back to John's question earlier, which curve was showing. So this is the black curves we were at before. So depending if your halos have NFW structures, if they're just point masses or so on, you get different structure for this power spectrum. But there's a lot more work to be done to actually derive this power spectrum. I mean, here, for instance, there's no two halo term. It's only like kind of Poisson distributed halos. So there's more work to be done into actually predicting what are we expecting from these data that I'm talking about here. And that motivates my next slide. I think this kind of approach leads you to kind of rethinking the way we think about galaxies. So, I mean, we've been thinking about galaxies as this big, complicated, nonlinear object that have disk and big, say big ellipticals and so on. The way I think about dark matter is they're big bags of dark matter. And you have some structure inside these bags, and but describing these structures in terms of their potential fluctuation has not been fully explored, because again the point here is that you want to repeat this analysis for all different types of gravitational lenses, and you want to combine this information into one big likelihood, because that's where the statistical paradox method is actually powerful. Is that when you have all this data, you want to combine this data. And the point is that the statistics of these fluctuations like galaxies are self-similar from one galaxy to the other. But this actually self-similarity is not well understood, and there's probably some selection functions and all these things that have to be explored, has not been very well explored. So there's still a bunch of work. I mean, this is kind of a parallel industry to lensing. It has nothing to do with the dark matter science, but just understanding galaxies from the potential fluctuation, what's the structure. Because the potential, talking in terms about, there's a potential power spectrum, you capture structures that are more than just bound subhalos. You talk about streams, disks, and all these other structures that actually contribute to the mass inside galaxies, and they're important to consider. So there's a bunch more work, and I want to encourage people to think about galaxies in a different way that's more applicable to the lensing and the dark matter problem. So there's all this data to play with, and the reason why you want to do this now and not in 20 years from now, it's because, I mean, we already have a lot of data, but there's a lot more coming up, and we're going to find a lot more of these lenses, and be ashamed of this data. It just goes to waste as far as dark matter science is concerned. There's a bunch of data that's going to come in and potentially other ones. And it's important to think about what's the best way we can analyze this data to get constraints on dark matter. Some of these missions tend to be more dark energy focused to mapping the expansion of the universe. And there's a lot of dark energy science coming out of this. But I think it would be interesting to try to maximize dark matter science out of these missions. And that's what I'm trying to do. All right, it's time to wrap up. So I convince you that if you want to go for dark matter physics from the purely gravitational / astrophysical side, you have to go inside galaxies, you have to go on small nonlinear scales. CMB and large gas structure will only do so much for you. So this strong gravitational lensing offer you some unique probe of probing this very small scale structure. And we're working on developing this kind of comprehensive framework that allows you to combine different types of data into one big constraint for these dark matter substructure. And we're currently indirectly implementing it. It's a lot of details to work out here. And stay tuned for sensitivity forecasts in the near future for all these missions I just mentioned about. That's it. Thanks.
Yeah. One or two questions for Francis Young, and then work session for lunch.
Oh, sorry. So in all your models where you showed the effective substructure, you had some known, you know, main lens, and then you added some substructure. But of course, in the real universe, you don't know what the main lens is necessarily.
Yeah.
So there are free parameters there.
Yeah, there are.
And so how do you disentangle the degeneracy between how much freedom you allow in fitting the main lens and how smooth that is versus what you call a substructure?
So the way we do that is that we have this big Monte Carlo engine, and we actually so the main lens is described by a whole slew of parameters, and these that describe like the size, elliptic, all the shape of this thing.
They're basically distorted NFWs or something, or elliptical NFWs. They're not NFWs,
but they're more general than that. But and at the end of the day, you need to marginalize all these properties. Because I'm not, but maybe other people are, but I'm not so interested in these global properties, so I want to marginalize over this. So all the properties.
Some assumptions in the smoothness of those somehow, which is built into the model.
Sure, I mean, it's kind of, I think this is what you're raising at, there's people in the lensing community, and I don't count myself really member of the lensing communities, because I only work about part-time, but some people that argue that you need a lot more freedom to the smooth lens model, and they, in fact, at some point they allow so much freedom that they use this pixelized mass model, where you just allow that every bend of the mass model to be completely free. But then the point is that then you lose. There's no constraint. I mean, you can do like sky's the limit. You can do anything you want. And I think this is where my comments were about the structure of galaxy. I mean, there's some prior. We have some idea about what a galaxy should look like. And we should apply this to coming up with these smooth model that's well motivated for this analysis. But we do want to marginalize the smooth model information as much as we can. That's the point, yeah.
Quick question. If you look at the data for the matter power spectrum, the nonlinear regime,
yeah.
If you look at the raw data, it's very scattered. It's a huge noise.
At a very small scale?
Even a small scale. So I...
Well, the last time I looked at BOSS data, at IK, the error bars are pretty low, but then that's only the galaxy power spectrum, the matter power spectrum. I mean, you have to understand the bias and everything. I mean, it's complicated. Well, I don't think binning is much of an issue. It's more, I think I just...
How do you extract the fact that?
No, but here, I'm not talking about large-scale structure. I mean, I'm just drawing the convergence power spectrum inside a galaxy. It's like a maximum lower K mode I want to go, and I want to go beyond. It's actually a different regime. I guess when you talk about the 3D power spectrum in the sky, talking about the projected power spectrum in a very small region, I think it's different here. It's not exactly the same thing. All right.